It is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, Roger Waite. Roger has been a member of WWF since 2004 and has considered himself a humanist for much of his life. This past year, he's been exposed to many interesting books and materials in the humanist group here at WWF as an adult RE group facilitated by Tom Needham. One book particularly piqued Roger's interest because it examines in detail the implications of modern science and what it can tell us about the existence of God. His talk today is based on that book, which is called God, the Failed Hypothesis. Welcome, Roger.
What can science tell us about God? Plenty, according to Victor J. Stenger. Stenger's the author of the book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, on which this talk is based. The subtitle is even more startling, How Science Shows That God Does Not Exist. Stenger received his BS in electrical engineering, then a master's and a PhD in physics. He took a position at the University of Hawaii teaching physics and astronomy, and has written extensively about the interface between physics and cosmology versus philosophy, religion, and what he calls pseudoscience. Throughout history, the arguments for and against the existence of God have been confined to philosophy and theology, with science taking a back seat. Usually, scientists and non-scientists alike avoid the notion that science can have anything to say about God. The argument is that science deals with the natural order and God with the supernatural. Therefore, they are different realms, and one should leave them always and forever separate. Well, Stenger disagrees and says that science most definitely has a role to play in the God hypothesis. Since the traditional God conceptualists, the people that conceptualize God, use the natural order for their proofs, such as miracles being the proof of God's power, then they should be open to science proving their footing. Of course, Stenger is talking about the traditional God of the three big monotheist religions, the three old gods, omnibenevolent, all-loving, omnipresent, here, there, and everywhere, and of course, omnipotent, all-powerful. This is the God of the Bible and the Quran. It's no fair using the tricks of some theologians to define God as the entity that created the Big Bang. Now, in a recent poll, 7% of scientists believed in God, while in the general population, the number is way over 50%. A large number of those believing scientists do not believe in miracles, whereas a majority of the non-scientists either believe in them or they pretend to. So how does Stenger proceed with his proofs? He starts by explaining scientific models and methods. These models objectify and quantify in order to distinguish what works and what doesn't. So once he's refreshed the reader's knowledge of science, he proceeds to state the 8 attributes of the God hypothesis. God is the creator and preserver of the universe. Is that... Okay, I can't see it. My eyes just aren't good enough. God is the architect of the structure of the universe. God steps in whenever he wishes to change the course of events, which may include violating his own laws. For example, in response to human entreaties, God is the creator and preserver of life and humanity, where human beings are special in relation to other life forms. Can we have the next slide? God has endowed humans with immaterial, external souls that exist independent of their bodies and carry the essence of a person's character and selfhood. 6. God is the source of morality and other human values such as freedom, justice, and democracy. 7. God has revealed truths in scriptures. And in communicating directly to select individuals throughout history. And finally, God does not deliberately hide from a human being who is open to finding evidence for his presence. Now, of course, it's easier to prove something is false than to prove it's true. But the 3O attributes are logically falsifiable. You've heard arguments such as, how can an all-loving and all-powerful God allow an innocent child to suffer? Whole books have been written about these philosophical arguments, and that is not the subject of this book. Here's Stenger's scientific argument against the existence of God, which is a modified form of the lack of evidence argument. Number one, hypothesize a God who plays an important role in the universe. 2, assume that God has specific attributes that should provide objective evidence of his existence. 3, look for such evidence with an open mind. If such evidence is found, conclude that God may exist. If such objective evidence is not found, conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that a God with these properties does not exist. Now, perhaps the argument heard most frequently purporting to prove the existence of God is the argument for design. The universe is so perfect. How could it possibly have arisen by accident? Of course, before the age of science, it was natural to assume that God had a hand in our creation. Even after Darwin's Origin of the Species showed how natural selection explained a natural mechanism for evolution, it was, after all, just a theory. I'm sure you've heard that. When the discovery of DNA proved Darwin correct in 1964, the controversy should have ended, but of course it didn't. Creationists, the literal interpreters of the Bible, have always been around to dispute evolution. But in the light of DNA's evidence, a new line of attack formed called intelligent design. None of the claims of these folks have held up to scientific scrutiny, but a biochemist named Behr, B-E-H-R, caused quite a stir in 1996 with his book, Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. His claim was that the theory of irreducible complexity, that is, the whole is equal to the sum of its parts, and if you remove one part, you know, the whole can't exist. This was a gotcha moment for the creationists. Here was a scientist with scientific proof that countered evolution. Now, Behr is a biochemist, not an evolutionary biologist, and was aware when he wrote the book, he was unaware when he wrote the book, that the mechanisms for the evolution of irreducible complexity irreducibly complex systems had already been discussed decades earlier. Many examples have been found of organs and biological structures that are understood to have arisen from a modification of the pre-existing structure rather than from careful engineering. The other individual that contributed to the rise of intelligent design is William Dembski. He isn't a scientist, but rather a theologian. But he's clever to count his turns in scientific-sounding gobbledygook. His book, Intelligent Design, The Bridge Between Science and Theology, has been completely debunked and is used even today, but it is used even today to prove the perceived flaws in evolutionary biology. Now, these authors and others are either naive or they're consciously making stuff up. None of their articles have appeared in scientific journals. The naivety may be the result of not grasping how natural selection works over enormous amounts of time to evolve complex systems from simple organisms. William Paley wrote a book about the concept of needing a design for complete processes or contrivances, such as the human eye, put forth the argument that the human eye is so perfect and complex that it must have had a designer. Well, it may be complex, but it's not perfect. There is a hole in everyone's retina, which our brain has been able to compensate for. While we were speaking about good design, why does almost everyone at some time in their life have back trouble? Our bones lose minerals after age 30, making them susceptible to fracture and osteoporosis. Our rib cage does not fully enclose and protect our internal organs. Our joints wear out. Our muscles atrophy. And the male prostate is a disaster. Don't get me started on that. Now, the Scientific American had an article showing what a properly designed female should look like. For this, I need a volunteer.
Forward-tilting torso, shorter limbs, okay. Extra padding around joints, extra muscles and fat, and, of course, thicker spinal disc and a reverse knee joint.
She'd be a much more efficient and healthy female, but a swimsuit model for Sports Illustrated? I don't think so. The point is that design is just an illusion. Now, is there a world beyond matter? Don't panic, but I'm now going to quote scripture. This is from King James Bible, Ecclesiastes 5, verses 5 and 6. For the living know not that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever of anything that is done under the sun. Very good, very wise thing. I don't think I've ever heard that from a pulpit. Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, has written a book called The Blind Watchmaker, which makes the point that now that we know how biology works and the enormous elapsed time involved in evolution, the conclusion is inescapable. Humans, and as they say, all of God's creatures, are exactly as you would expect to find them if there were no design of God. Dawkins goes further with this quote. Now, this doesn't endear him to religious folks at all. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Now, almost from the time humans appeared on the scene, tens of thousands of years ago, they seem to have had this vague notion that they were special and were more than the physical body that was born of women, grew and aged, eventually ceased to breathe, and finally disintegrated into a pile of empty bones. At some point, almost every culture imagined that invisible spirits ruled this process. Now, in the pre-scientific world, it seemed natural to have these kinds of feelings. First, it was assumed that the heart contained the essence of a person, as the brain's function wasn't yet discovered. Early Greek philosophers attributed thinking and feeling to an immortal soul located in or around the heart. Later, the soul was imagined to be split between the heart and the brain. Wherever its location, the soul was believed to be the conduit to the spirit world. When a person took his last breath, the soul was then free to leave the body. It was natural then for the major religions to use this concept in their teachings. It's true that there was a school of thought led by Epicurus in 270 BCE that believed that the soul was made up of matter like everything else. Their writings were lost to history, only to be rediscovered during the Reformation. Most people, even today, take for granted a separateness or duality of soul and body, spirit and matter. Brain science today, with MRIs and other brain imaging techniques, has shown that localized stimulation of brain cells can induce many of the types of experiences that people have interpreted as religious or spiritual, including out-of-body experiences, where a person's consciousness seems to become detached from the body. There is no evidence for anything happening outside of the physical processes of the brain. What about the force of life? Many cultures have held the belief that there is a special vital force that distinguishes live organisms from inanimate objects. Even today, you hear terms like chai. That's spelled Q-I for the Scrabble people. Used to represent some special energy that is supposed to flow through the body. Science has not found anything not explained by physics and chemistry. All right then, say the faithful. God must exist because he answers prayers. Really? Is there any evidence? With millions of faithful issuing prayers every day, shouldn't we be able to prove that it works? In 2001, there was quite a stir when the so-called Columbia Study appeared on national television's Good Morning America. The study purported to show that in groups of women trying to conceive using in vitro fertilization, the prayed-for group conceived at twice the rate of the non-prayed-for group. Naturally, the notoriety caused scrutiny of the conditions of the test, which then proved no difference at all. There have been many studies trying to prove the efficacies of prayer. None have lived up to scientific scrutiny. Well, immortality is a big draw for many believers. This concept makes all the suffering and hardships of life worthwhile to many believers. But what actually survives death? Neurological and medical evidence strongly suggest memories, emotions, thoughts, indeed our very personalities, reside in the physical particles of the brain. So it would seem when the brain dies, we die. Historically, the Catholic Church has taught that the full body is resurrected. God simply reassembles everything. Is there any evidence of this? Shouldn't there be some trail or cookie crumbs, perhaps? Okay, what about cosmological evidence? A concept of a first cause is big in Christian theology. Whatever begins has a cause. The universe began, therefore the universe has a cause. Now, this is not a scientific argument, but even if true, a cause could be accidental. The empirical data and theories that explain the data indicate that the universe did not come about by a purposeful creation. To quote Stephen Hawking, so long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator. But if the universe is completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place then for a creator? Of course, there's the argument that God created the universe in such a way that it did not require miracles and therefore did not leave an imprint of his intentions. Of course, this would not be a traditional Judeo-Christian Islamic God whose imprint is supposedly everywhere. But if this were the case, wouldn't we be able to find the exceptions to the natural order? If God created the universe not using natural processes, shouldn't there be some evidence? The field of cosmology is new and exciting, but the evidence of Newton's theory of gravity has been around for 400 years. It is still true when explaining the orbits of satellites. Now, along with Einstein's theory of relativity and the discovery of background radiation, we know that the universe is expanding and everything works with no miraculous creation needed. History gives many examples of, at the time, unexplained events in the heavens that appeared miraculous. In 565 BCE, a total eclipse of the sun over Asia Minor ended a battle when both sides fled in terror. In what may have been the first known scientific prediction, Thales of Miletus had predicted the eclipse based on Babylonian records. Comets are another example of spectacular astronomical phenomena that ancient people thought were supernatural omens. Halley in 1742 used mechanical theories developed by Sir Isaac Newton to predict that a comet seen in 1682 would return 1759, and indeed it did. And at no time have we seen an event that did not repeat and act according to known science. So the origin and operation of the universe do not require any violations of the laws of physics. This may surprise the layperson who may have heard otherwise from the pulpit or from the media, who protest that these laws have to have originated outside of the universe. But there's no reason why the laws of physics cannot have come from the universe itself. Now, why is there something rather than nothing? This is an age-old argument, especially from the theist who seeks an argument for the existence of God by using physics and cosmology. Philosopher B.D. Rundle calls this philosophy's most central and perplexing question. The short answer is that nothing is unstable. That is, something is more stable than nothing. The natural state of affairs is something rather than nothing. An empty universe requires supernatural intervention, not a full one. Only by constant action of an outside agent could a state of nothingness exist. The fact that we have something is just what we would expect if there is no God. Well, what about revelation? The God of Jews, Christians, and Muslims is believed to communicate with humanity. The knowledge they claim to have received from God has filled religious literature. Throughout history, people have claimed deep, life-altering mystical experiences and formed prophecies based on their visions. Of course, there's no independent verification. The event has to be verifiable and repeatable to pass scientific muster. Well, what about scientific evidence in Scripture? With thousands of religions, past and present, there are numerous creation myths out there. The one we are most familiar with is the one in Genesis. Observations now show that the earth was formed 9 billion years after the Big Bang, grossly contradicting the events presented in Genesis. There's also a slight discrepancy of less than 10,000 years here versus 4.5 billion years over here. It doesn't quite add up. There is no physical evidence that things happened as expressed in the so-called proofs of Scripture. The anecdotes taken by many to be literal truths reflect the emotions and non-scientific prejudices of the time. Do our values come from God? The Old Testament is filled with atrocities committed in the name of God. Did the New Testament improve on the record? Oh, sure, if you forget about religious wars, the Crusades, and the Inquisition. I rest my case.
And now we have, light is glaring on the clock, we have a good 10, 12 minutes for discussion, questions and answers.
I'm Jim, and I am as much an atheist as anybody, I think, since I find no evidence of God, and I kind of like Tom Needham's statement that he says he loves a bumper sticker that says, really, I don't know, and you don't either. And yet I find your talk here rather confusing, since I don't quite figure out what you're arguing against. Are you arguing against the Abrahamic faith? Well, perhaps. But then you move around and you argue against more general things. And you take the point that most of the arguments in favor of God are sophistry. And yet you put up a straw man at the very beginning to knock down. And so I'm finding that, well, I agree with your conclusion. I don't think your argument works.
Of course, I just took certain pieces. I realized I didn't cover everything. But I have the book here. You can look at it.
David Leduca. I remember at a young age being in a science classroom and being in a, you know, theistic church. And I remember when it happened for me. I was going to ask you the question. Did you, at a young age, did you fall away from the God hypothesis in like a religious setting or in a science setting?
Well, I guess it was after when I got to college and took philosophy of religion and all of those types of courses. I didn't really think much about it in high school. We went to First Congregational Church, downtown Portland, and our minister was very cerebral. I used to enjoy his sermons, try to follow them and to their conclusions and so forth.
Philosophy of religion class for me, too. Although I went into college believing in God, and I took a philosophy of religion course from a professor who also believed in God. And yet, at the end of the course, I felt like, that's all we've got?
I really enjoyed your talk, but I found myself feeling sympathy for the theists. I mean, and it's because I think of my grandmother, who was a very dedicated Christian. And I grew up in a family where my father, she kept trying to convert my father. He was an atheist. And I always felt sorry for her. I had this sympathy for her. And I just wanted to share that. I don't know what it means. But I sat here feeling really sorry for the people who believe in God in that way. Whatever that's, there you go. What that means.
Well, for me, I kept asking questions, even in grade school, I was asked to shut up by the teachers over and over again. And the key was, your faith isn't very strong, is it? But nobody could answer my questions.
I know for myself that when things are bad or when I just need solace, that I pray. I don't expect it to be answered. It's just a way of me stating my needs. I don't expect intercession or anything. I know that when things are rough, I'll say the Our Father. You know, I'll just go back to the mantra just because it carries me over a bad spot. It isn't that I expect an intercession because I know that's absurd, but it's for me. It's just for me.
This, for me, evokes a little bit of an argument for the possibility that there could be a God, in the sense that it just feels often intense certainty one way or the other is human arrogance, in a sense. Like, how are we to know that we are at the stage in life where we have all the perception necessary to test all the theories that exist, and that we are living in the age of a perfect science? Because we're not. I mean, it just keeps changing. So belief either way always, to me, feels sort of arrogant. I don't know. I think the mystery is the point.
Yeah, well, this wasn't a this I believe. This is presenting Stenger's concepts in his book.
I have a question. In this book, how does he explain life?
Does not. It's just a natural process that came into being with the right components. Go for it.
Although personally, I find the idea of a supernatural being or substance or anything totally unbelievable, I kind of like the argument that there is no objective verifiable way of proving or disproving whether there is such a creature.
Yeah.
But the question remains, does it make any difference? I do not see any evidence that it does. So it's not even an important question.
I found myself observing through this whole talk a split within myself. I have never had a belief in atheist spirit. And being raised in Wisconsin around a bunch of Lutherans, I was looked at as very odd. And yet, being in medicine and being a therapist, I've come to realize there is a meaning for people of having something outside of themselves that motivates them to endure very difficult times and to operate for the greater good. Habitat for Humanity was driven by a passion that came from a theist belief. And I think we get caught up in things like the Crusades and the evil sides of the excuse of God, but we're forgetting it does drive people to do things for the greater good that never get noted or recognized. I was a mental health responder to 9/11, and I found myself responding, as I'm thinking about this, how many people I was on the street with, that it was their faith in God that helped them get up the next morning. Yes, but that was not the majority opinion. And I think as a therapist, I've worked in crisis intervention for so many years. I've walked through times parents have lost their children in a hospital and have asked why, but then have come through with something of, I'm not alone. And science explains, I'm in medicine, and religion, Western religion, held back medicine a long time. And yet, science doesn't address the relational issues. It can never reach out to that. And I do feel that as this discussion happens, that I feel a passion of, let's respect. There is a reason. There's a meaning here. Whatever it serves. Every society seems to reach towards something. That's a universal, whatever being it is. And I think it's about the relational piece, and I don't like that to be forgotten. And I feel at times the theists kind of get made fun of. And that's my concern. So thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Seems to me, and you've said it, that there are a number of people who believe in God, and there are a number of people who don't. The question that I have is not about is there a God or is there not a God. It's, and some people are speaking close to this, is why does the human race or a portion of the human race believe in a God? why is God, the idea of God, necessary to some people? And why is it, and I use myself as an example, so difficult? It's been really difficult for me, and I'm not sure I've done it, to talk, to learn myself out of a belief in God. And I'm one of the unchurched. My parents didn't go to church. They didn't take me to church. I don't know where I got the idea. It just culturally grew up with the idea that there's a God. And when the most difficult time for me to say, no God, is when I find myself in some kind of trouble, wanting something bigger than myself to take care of me or win for me. Those are my questions, and I don't know whether he has an answer for any of those or not, or whether you've read other sources.
He's running for president, isn't he? That's part of the human condition.
Part of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
So I still ask, why?
From the first human that saw their reflection in the water, yeah. What is this wonder? What is this? So far, we're the only creature that can do that.
And thank you again, Roger.